victory, back when he was still a political officer with the Hyakon Eighth. Gaunt loathed all chaos, but loathed especially the tendrils of it, which had escaped destruction at Balhaut, only to twist and pollute other worlds, thanks, as he saw it, to the tactical miscalculations of Warmaster Makaroth. Gaunt had spoken of Sholan Skara, renegade of the Balhaut murder camps, as if he had known him personally. That was why the Colonel Commissar had volunteered his ghosts for the Osprey assault. He had made it plain to them all. And that, mused Kafran, was why they had been drowned and blasted and torn apart on the razor wire. Kafran often thought about Gaunt. Ibram Gaunt. He rolled the name in his mind, a name he would never dare voice aloud. The Colonel. The Commissar. A strange man, and Kafran's feelings for him were strange too. He was the best, most caring, most charismatic leader Kafran could imagine. Kafran had seen, time and again, the way Gaunt looked after the ghosts. Kafran had also seen enough of other regiments and their commanders and politicos to know how rare a thing that was. Many, like beloved Colonel Corbeck, regarded Gaunt as a savior, a friend, a brother, and Kafran could not deny he admired Gaunt and would follow him to the ends of any earth. But Kafran knew Fagor, Rorn, and the other malcontents well, and in bitter moments he shared their contempt for the Colonel Commissar. For all his fatherly love, like their own private emperor, Gaunt had left Tanith to die. From time to time, Kafran had been tempted to throw aside his reservations about Gaunt and worship him, as so many others did. But always that creeping resentment in his heart had stopped him from total devotion. Gaunt was ruthless, calculating, direct. He would never stint from sending men to their deaths, for his duty was to the Emperor and to the rule of Terra long before it was to the lost souls of Tanith. Kafran saw the boy Milo, the so-called adjutant, as a constant reminder of the lost youth of his homeworld. Milo was only a year or two younger than Kafran, but a gulf divided them. He never spoke to the boy. Gaunt, in his oh-so-generous wisdom, had saved Milo from the fires of Tanith Magna. Saved one, but no one else. Kafran thought, at such times, of Laria. How he had loved her. How very much. All Kafran knew for sure was that Laria was dead now. How she had died, he had no idea, and, frankly, he was thankful for that. But Laria haunted him. Laria embodied everything he had lost. Tanith itself, his friends, his life, his family. For Laria's sake, Kafran knew he would always remain one of those ghosts in the middle way, one who would follow Gaunt to hell devoutly, but would never forgive him when they arrived. Here, in the wall gully of Osprey, it was easy to hate Gaunt. The stink of death and fire filled the place. Kafran slid in low against a fallen tower of stone blocks as he approached the opening into the island proper. Val, McKendrick, and Trooper Vulliam dropped in beside him. Behind them, down the crash chasm at the mouth of the breach, Kafran could hear shouts and grinding tracks. He looked at Val questioningly.
"The Fething Basilisks," the sergeant said. "They want to storm in ahead of the infantry, but they can't get their fat asses into the gap."
"Then we still have point," Kafran smiled.
"Feth the armor."
Val chortled. "Feth them indeed. Did us no favors on Voltimand, doing us no favors now."
Val signaled the advance beyond the breach gap, and 59 ghosts rose from cover and moved forward. Vulliam, 2 meters ahead of Kafran, was one of the first to break into the open. Stub rounds broke him messily into 4. 6 more ghosts died as they broke cover. Though hammered, the Kith had their side of the chasm in the wall soundly covered. Kafran fell back with the others as las rounds and bolts and stub charges peppered the exit of the breach. In cover, they lay trembling as the deadly rain continued to drum the opening ahead.
"Blocked as surely as we were before,"
Domor said, scratching at his eye sutures.
"You were right," McKendrick asked.
"Vision's a little foggy. Got water in there. Hope—"
Domor said no more, but Kafran knew what he was thinking. The seawater had ruined Val's arm, and now it seemed to be starting its slow work on Domo's eyes.
"Might as well have left this Fethin wall standing for all the good it's going to do us," Trooper Callan said. Val nodded, nursing his strapped arm. His last pistol, the only weapon he could handle now, lay in his lap.
What about missiles? Munitions? McKendrick wondered. We could blow them out and...
What do we aim at? Val asked, sourly. Do you even see them? McKendrick settled back with no answer. Ahead of them was nothing but a sliced mouth cut in the wall. Beyond, the steeple girders and scaffolds of the refinery, 30 stories high. The enemy gunners could be anywhere. Silence fell. Sandflies billowed around the dead, and oceanic carrion swooped in to peck at the cindered flesh with hooked, pink beaks. The birds mobbed the chasm, squawking and shrilling. Trooper Tokar drove them off with a scatterburst of lasfire. There was movement and voices behind them. Kafran and the others turned to see several Ketzok gunnery troopers creeping their way, pausing to exchange words with each group of ghosts. One hurried over to them, bent double, and saluted Val's Sergeant Patch as he crouched next to them.
Corporal Fuega, Ketzok 17th Serpents.
Val, Sergeant, Ghost, and your purpose is? Fuega scratched his ear for a moment, unmanned by Val's attitude.
Our basilisks can't manage this breach, so we're going to split it wider with shelling. My commander asks you to fall back out of the fire zone.
Wish he'd given us such a warning on Voltimand, Domo said icily. Fuega stepped back.
That black day is forever in our shame, Tanith. If we could give anything, even our lives, to change it, we would.
I'm sure you would, Val sneered. He got up to face the Ketzok corporal. What's the plan? Fuega coughed.
Orders from General Klein. You pull out, we shell, then we advance with heavy infantry.
Heavy infantry?
The Volponi have just beached in Legion strength. They have heavy armor and weapons. We will clear the way for their advance.
Fuega turned away.
You have 15 minutes to withdraw.
The ghosts sat in a stupefied gaggle.
All this? All we lost for nothing?
Domo sighed. Val was angry.
Faith, those Volponi, and the Ketzok too. We die in the wire to open the beach, and then they march in and follow the tanks to glory.
I don't know about you, Sergeant, but I don't want to be sitting here still complaining about life when those basilisks open up. Val spat and sighed.
Me neither.
Okay, by platoon team, call the retreat. The ghosts all around scrambled up and prepared to fall back. Domo, looking up, caught Kafran by the arm.
What? Up there, do you see it?
Domo pointed, and Kafran looked up. The broken wall rose like a cliff above them, scabbed with slumping masonry and broken reinforcement girders. 50 meters up, just above a severed end of pipework, Kafran saw the door.
Faith, but your eyes are sharp. There were tunnels in the wall, troop tunnels buried deep. This hole has cut through one of them and exposed it.
Kafran called Val over, and a group of ghosts gathered to look up.
We could get a fire team inside the wall, follow the tunnel to wherever it led us.
Hell? Supposed Trooper Flavin.
That's high up, Val began.
But the cliff is ragged and full of good handholds. The first man up could secure a line. Sergeant, it's a plan.
Val looked round at Kafran.
I'd never make it with one arm dead.
Who'd lead?
I could, said Sergeant Gawley of 5 Platoon.
He was a tall, barrel-chested man with a boxer's nose.
You get the wounded back onto the beach. I'll take a squad and see what we can do.
Val nodded. He began to round up the walking wounded and seconded several able bodies to help him with the more seriously injured. Gawley selected his commando squad. Kafran, Domor, McKendrick, Flavin, Tokar, Bude, Adare, McCallan, Kale. McKendrick, raised in the mountains of Tanith Steeple, led off, clambering up the splintered wall, hand over hand. He left his flamer and its tanks with Gawley to raise them later on a line. By the time the ascent was made and ropes secured, their leeway was almost up, and the 10 ghosts were alone in the chasm. Within moments, the basilisks at the throat of the breach would start their bombardment. The men went up quickly, following the ropes. Gawley was last, securing a line around the flamer unit and other heavy supplies. The team at the top, crowded into the splintered doorway, hauled them up. Gawley was halfway up the ascent when the bombardment began. The 9 ghosts above cowered into the shelter of the concrete passageway they had climbed into and covered their ears at the concussion. a shell hit the wall and vaporized Gourley, as if he had never been there. Realizing he was gone, Kafran urged the party to collect their equipment and move inwards. Soon this entire wall section would be brought down. The ghost squad crept up the unlit passageway. Though generally intact, the tunnel had slumped a little, following the massive shockwave from the troopship crash. The ground was split in places, exposing crumbling rock. Pipes and cables dangled from the cracked roof. Dust trickled down from deep fissures. In places, the shock impact had sectioned the wall, cutting the originally straight and horizontal tunnel into a series of cleanly stepped slabs. The Tanith clambered on, probing the dusty darkness with the cold green glare of assault lamps. Behind them, the stonework of the great sea wall began to shake. The Ketzok had redoubled their furious work. Kafran found himself leading, as if there had been an unspoken vote electing him in Gourley's place. He presumed it was because he had suggested this incursion in the first place. The ghosts picked up their speed and moved deeper into the tunnel system that threaded the marrow of the wall. They reached a vertical communications shaft, down the center of which ran a great wrought iron spiral staircase. The air was damp and smelled of wet brick and the sea. Shock damage was evident here, too, and the bolts securing the metal stairway and its adjoining walkways to the shaft's sides had sheared off or snapped. The entire metal structure, hundreds of tons of it filling the shaft, creaked uneasily with each shuddering impact from the guns of the distant basilisks. The ghosts stepped across the metal landing of the stair coil to where the tunnel resumed beyond. It squealed and yelped with every step, sometimes threatening to tilt or fall. Kale and Flavin were last across. A metal bolt end the size of a man's forearm rang off the gantry, just missing Kale. It had come loose far above. "Move!" yelled Kafran. With a protesting, non-vocal scream, the staircase collapsed, tearing itself apart and rattling away down into the black depths of the bottomless shaft. Where larger parts of the structure remained intact, a few turns of steps laced together, a long section of handrail, a series of stanchion poles, they fell with heavy fury, raking sparks and hideous shrieks from the shaft walls. Empty, the stairs fallen away, the brick shaft seemed immense, uncrossable. Domo looked back at the tunnel they had come along, out of reach now across the gulf. "No going back now," he muttered. "Good thing that's not the way we're going," Kafran replied, pointing into the darkness to come with the barrel of his lasgun. Wide cisterns opened up around them. The cement floors were painted with glossy green paint, and the wall bricks matte white. The walls tapered upwards so that the ceiling was narrower than the floor, and the whole tunnel turned a few degrees to the left. The entire passageway was following both the line and the profile of the wall it ran through. Grilled lighting panels, glowing phosphorescent white, hung at intervals from the roof. They looked like a giant stream of tracer rounds, arcing off down the line of the tunnel, frozen in time. Kafran's ghosts, and indeed now they were his ghosts, bonding to him as leader now that they were cut off from outside without asking or deciding, haunted the long passageways, hugging the walls in the fierce white glow of the lights. Every 60 meters, tunnels bisected the main route on the inland side, deep, wide throats of brick and concrete that sloped downwards. McKendrick thought they might be drainage channels, but if that was true, the size alarmed Kafran. They were big enough to take a man walking upright, and just as broad. If that kind of liquid quantity flooded these tunnels from time to time, Domo believed the channels to be for personnel movement, or for running carts of ammo and supplies up to the emplacements buried in the sides and along the top of the Great Sea Wall. But they'd seen no vertical cargo shafts for munitions lifting, and Kafran doubted sheer manpower could roll enough shells up the sloping channels without mechanical assistance. And they had met no one, not a trace of the Kith soldiery, not even a corpse. "They're all fully engaged, deploying on the defences," Kale suggested. Kafran thought it a fair bet. "We wanted to get inside. I figure we might get further than we expected." They had just reached the latest of the mysterious sloping shafts. Kafran nodded to it. "It leads into the heart of the island itself. Let's try it." "And then what?" Bude asked. "Then? I mean, what's your plan, Kaf?" Kafran paused.
Getting in, that had been everything. Now,
we're inside, he began. No one's got this far.
Bude and others nodded. But what then? Flavin asked. Again, Caffran was lost for words.
We see how far we can get. Inside.
None demurred. Lighting in the sloped tunnel was built into the wall and hidden behind transparent baffles. The concrete floor had a mesh grill set into it, providing greater purchase for walking. They moved in formation, half a kilometre by Domor's gyro compass. A kilometre. The air became damp cold. The tunnel began to level out. The distant thump and shudder of the seawall assault dimmed behind them. They heard the humming before they saw the end of the tunnel. A low, ululating throb that bristled the air. It reminded Caffran of the heavy fruit wasps in the Nal forests of Tanith, crossing glades on iridescent wings to bury their long ovipostas into soft bark in search of Nal grubs to use as living kindergartens. Adare, at the head of the pack with McCallan, called out. The tunnel was sealed 50 meters ahead by a vast metal hatchway. A thick, ironwork seal surrounded a man-sized hatch closed with lever latches and greased hydraulic hinges. The door and its frame were painted matte green with rust-proof paint, all except the clean steel inner rods of the extended hydraulics, which glittered with filmy brown oils. The throbbing was coming from the far side of the hatch. Adare checked the hatch seals, but they were wound tightly shut and locked, it seemed, from the other side. Caffran shouldered his way forward and reached out a hand to the metal barrier. It was wet cold, but it tingled, vibrating gently with the reverberations behind it.
How do we get through?
Caffran murmured. Do we want to get through? Bude returned. Domo knelt down and started to open the clasps of his sweeper pack. Caffran noted with some concern that Domo was regularly pausing to fidget and scratch at his eyes now, as if irritated by persistent flies. Domo pulled the head of the sweeper broom out of the pack, removed the soft cloth bag it was wrapped in, and carried it to the wall with his set unit and his headphones. He plugged the headphones and the sweeper head into the unit and switched it on, listening patiently to the clicking returns in his earpieces as he moved the flat pad of the sweeper head across the metal door surround. 3 or 4 times he stopped, went back to check, and then marked the green-painted metal with a graphite cross, using a stick he kept in his bicep pocket. Domor turned back to Caffran, pulling his headphones back down around his neck.
The main internal lock for the hatch is buried inside the frame. Those crosses mark the threads of the gears.
Caffran let Tokar do the honors. He put a point-blank las round through each of the crosses, leaving round puncture holes with sharp metal edges. The latches and locks spun free easily, now their mechanisms were ruined. Adare and Flavin hauled the green hatch open, and the ghosts crept forward into a blue, gloomy realm of smoke. Caffran knew they were emerging on the land side of the Great Sea Wall, deep in the refinery complex of Oscray Island. They were exiting onto a lattice walkway of scrubbed iron that jutted out of the fastness wall and crossed a gulf whose depths he had no way of judging. Above, below, and around, everything was smoke. The walkway was 5 meters wide, with a low handrail, and reached across 40 meters to a tower that rose skeletally out of the haze. The air smelled of cordite and salt. It was cold and clammy suddenly. Caffran scanned around. Behind them, the way they had come, he was just able to make out the back of the vast seawall rising up, lost in the fog. The throbbing and pulsing was much louder now, and Caffran knew it must be coming from the fuel mills, the promethium pumps, and the other working systems of the vast refinery. Domo was next to him, prying into the smoke with his prosthetic eyes. The focus rings were buzzing now, and he strained with them. Thick, discolored tears trickled down his stubbled cheeks. The salt water had really done its devious work.
"This smoke is backwash from the enemy's guns along the wall top," Domo said. "The sea air and the downdraft of our ships is blowing it back over the wall, and it's pooling here in the inner basin of the refinery."
All the better for them to move unseen, thought Caffran. But to where? Adrenaline had brought them so far. Where was the plan? They were nearly at the tower, a vast red-painted skeletal needle of girders with dull flashing lamps at the corners. Other walkways stretched away from it into the soupy air. Kafran was beginning to make sense of the place and picked out other catwalks and walkways above, below, and parallel to the one the ghosts used, through the billowing smoke. Laser fire peppered down at them suddenly, rebounding from the iron walkway or punching through it. Bude stumbled as a round hit him in the top of the left shoulder and exited through his right hip. Kafran knew he was dead, but he tried desperately to get to him nevertheless. Bude leaned on the rail for a moment, upright, then pitched over and fell away into the smoke below, silently. There were dark shapes on a catwalk 40 meters above and to the left of them. More zinging fire spat down through the clouds. The ghosts opened up in return, pasting shots up into the roof of the smoke. A body fell past them. McKendrick swiveled his flamer and vomited huge curls of fire up at the enemy position. The catwalk above them collapsed and spilled 4 fire-streaming comets down into the chasm, burning, screaming, flailing human forms. Kafran led the way to the tower at a run and entered a grilled-off section that faced an open-sided elevator car. Kale and McCallan joined him first, the others close on their heels. A steep stairwell of open-backed mesh steps led both down and up the tower alongside the open elevator shaft. More lasfire and stub rounds started spanking off the ironwork and tinging around the metal cage of the tower. "Which way?" bellowed Kale. "Up," Kafran decided. "Where's the sense in that? We'll be trapped like rats at the top of the tower with nowhere to run." "No," Kafran countered, trying desperately to think. He was trying to bring back the briefing. The Commissar had shown them aerial views of the Osgray facility, concentrating on the seawall area they were meant to assault. He tried to picture the other inner derrick areas he had glimpsed. Towers, dozens of them, just like the one on which they stood, bridging to each other at various levels, including some higher than the sea wall. If that was true, if the memory was true, they could cross to other towers higher up as well as lower down. "Trust me," Kafran said, and started up the stairs, blasting las rounds over the side at distant walkways where muzzles flashed in their direction. They ascended. Kafran fought the panic in his mind. The way in, the chance to sneak inside, had seemed a good plan, a brave plan. But now they were here, 8 men alone in a city of the enemy. He had no idea what they had even expected to be able to achieve. There was no plan, not even the raw materials for a plan. He dreaded any of the others asking him to explain their purpose here. Fire from below. 3 or 4 stories down, squads of Kith soldiery were moving up the tower, blasting upwards. Las rounds popped and thumped through the mesh steps around them. McCallan lost the front of his foot and toppled screaming in pain. Adare, just a few steps below him, arrested his fall and hauled the whimpering man up with him. The others blasted downwards and an odd vertical firefight began, laser salvos spitting up and down the tower structure. McKendrick, last of the ascending ghosts, hosed the stairs below them with his flamer, and belching clouds of fire drizzled down through the open metal edifice and torched the closest of the pursuers. 6 more flights up, a bridging walkway opened to their left, crossing the smoky chasm to another tower. There seemed to be no one on the other structure, and Kafran gestured the men across, stopping to help Adare with McCallan. Adare grabbed Kafran's shoulder and pointed to the swiftly ascending elevator in the tower they were leaving. It was packed with enemy troopers, climbing far faster than those on the stairs. Kafran sent Adare hobbling onwards with McCallan, then pulled a pair of tube charges from his pack. He set short fuses and rolled them along the bridge onto the tower deck, then ran to join the others. The blast tore through the tower assembly, blowing out stanchions and main supports all around. With a deafening howl, the tower crumpled and collapsed, hundreds of meters of steeple section from above, sliding down with almost comical slowness, splintering the body of the tower below. The packed elevator car fell like a stone. Power servos tore out and exploded. Secondary explosions rippled out into the gloom. The collapse tore away the bridge they had just crossed by and ripped the bridge supports out of their side of the crossing, shearing metal and girders around them, shaking the other tower. Heavier impacts shook them as bridges higher up tore loose with the descending tumult and came slamming or dragging down the length of their tower. From below, as the tower mass crashed to the ground, other explosions fluttered out as fuel stores and pumps detonated under the impact. Plumes of fire gusted around them.
"What the feth have you done?"
bellowed Flavin. Cafran wasn't sure. In desperation, he hadn't really thought through the consequences of mining the tower. One simple thing occurred to him.
"I've bought us some time," he whispered.
Now they moved downwards, partly because down seemed to make sense, and partly because none of them trusted the stability of the tower, now that its neighbour had been torn so brutally away. They descended into thicker, blacker smoke. Bright cinders floated on the wind, and there was a deep, rank smell of burning fuel and spilt promethium. Even from here, they knew the collapsing tower had done vast damage to the plant. Down, thought Cafran. Still, he had no plan he could speak of, but Down seemed to be instinctively right. What could they do here except perhaps some small, specific act, like take out the Kith's command, Carder? He laughed to himself as he thought the words. Bold, ridiculous words. As if they could even find Sholan Skara and his seniors in an island hive this size. But it was a notion worth hanging on to. A few hundred meters from the ground, he instructed his men to work stealthily, to do what the ghosts did best. They blackened their skin with soot from the handrails and pulled down their camo cloaks, melting into the darkness of the smoke and the blackened tower scaffold. Below them, around the base of the tower, twisted burning wreckage lay scattered 500 meters in every direction. Flames leapt from small legs of petroleum and mineral gels. The debris from the fallen tower, some of it great chunks of tower section, intact and twisted on the concrete, crushed beneath it smaller buildings and storage blocks, cranes and other rig service vehicles. Charred bodies lay crumpled or burst here and there. They passed at least one section of walkway dangling from their tower like a loose flap, clanking as it swung back and forth against the girders. Reedy klaxons barked through the smoke like the sound of yapping guard dogs. They strode out from the base of the tower into the wreckage in fireteam formation. Cafran and Tokar at point. Domor supported the hopping McCallan. Cafran wasn't going to leave him behind. Spools of chain, frayed wire hawsers, splashes of oil and metal litter covered the concourse. Cafran skirted around a pair of Kith corpses, men who had clung together as they fell and been mangled into one hideous ruin by the ground. Sending McKendrick ahead in his place, Cafran dropped back to check on Domor and McCallan. A hefty shot of analgesic had left McCallan vacant, lolling and useless. Domor was blind. The iris shutters on his bionic implants had finally failed and shut tight. Filmy fluid leaked around the focusing rings and wept down his face. It hurt Cafran to see his friend like this. It was like Menazoid Epsilon all over again, when Domor had lost his eyes and still fought on without them, playing his part with a valor and tenacity even Gaunt had been awed by. "Leave us," Domor told him. Cafran shook his head. He wiped away the sweat that beaded his brow and trickled down the blue dragon tattoo on his temple. Cafran opened McCallan's pack and took out a one-shot plastic injector of adrenaline, stamping it into McCallan's bare forearm. The injured trooper roared as he came out of his stupor. Cafran slapped him.
"Domo will be your legs. You have to be his eyes."
McCallan growled and then spat and nodded as he understood. The adrenaline rush was killing all his pain and re-fortifying his limbs.
"I can do it," he said,
clutching hold of Domor hard. They moved on. Beyond the area of debris, the hive complex was a warren of drum silos and loading docks, red-washed girder towers marked with the Imperial Eagle and then defaced with sickening runes of chaos. In one open concourse, there was a row of 50 cargo trucks, flatbeds, smashed and burned out. Along one wide access ramp, millions of sections of broken pipe and hose scattered in small random mounds. Inside one damaged silo, countless pathetic bodies were piled and jumbled, a mass grave of those Oscrey workers who would not join Skara's cause.
So Flavin suggested.
"Perhaps not," Cafran said, covering his mouth and nose with the edge of his cloak as he looked in. "Enemy insignia there, and armor. These aren't long dead."
"When have they found time to gather and pile their dead? There's an assault going on."
Cafran agreed with Flavin's incredulity, but the signs were there.
What purpose, what peculiar intent lay behind this charnel heap?
They heard shots, a ripple of lasfire from beyond the silo, and swung in close, moving with the shadows. More shots, another almost simultaneous volley. Perhaps 100 guns, thought Kafran. He ordered them to stay down and crept forward with Adare. What they saw beyond the next bunker shocked them. There was a wide concourse, almost a kilometer square, at the heart of this part of the island complex. From the markings on the ground, this had been a landing pad for the cargo lighters. Across the center, 1,000 Kith soldiers stood in ranks of 100. Facing them was a messy litter of bodies, which tractors with fork shovels and dozer blades were heaping into freight trucks. Kafran and Adare watched. The front rank of the Kith took 20 steps forward and turned to face the other rows. At a signal from a nearby officer, what was now the front rank raised their weapons and cut the file of 100 men down in an uneven burst of gunfire. As the tractors pushed the bodies aside, the rank that had fired stepped forward and marched to where their targets had been. They turned, waited. Another order, another ripple of fire. Kafran wasn't sure what sickened him most, the scale of the mass firing squads, or the willing, uncomplaining way each rank slew the last and then stepped forward and waited to be cut down.
"What the faith are they doing?" Adare gasped.
Kafran thought for a moment, reaching into his memory to recover the parts of the briefing he had blanked. The parts where Gaunt had spoken about Sholan Skara. It came back to him, out of the darker reaches of his mind, recollections rising like marsh gas bubbles out of the mire of forgetfulness. Suddenly, Gaunt's voice was in his ear, Gaunt's image before him. The briefing auditorium of the mighty troopship Persistence. Gaunt, in his long storm coat and cap, striding onto the dais under the stone lintel of the staging, glancing up at the gilt-spread eagle with its double heads on the velvet drop behind him. Gaunt, removing his coat and dropping it on the black leather chair, standing there in his dress jacket, taking off his cap once to smooth his cropped hair as the men came to order. Gaunt, speaking of the abominations and filthy concepts Kafran had blanked from his mind. "Sholan Skara is a monster. He worships death. He believes it to be the ultimate expression of the chaotic will. On Balhaut, before we came in, he ran murder camps. There, he ritually slaughtered nearly 1 billion Balhautians. His methods were inventive, and," even now, Kafran could not bring himself to think of Gaunt's descriptions, "the names of the foul species of chaos that Sholan Skara had commanded, the symbolic meaning of their crimes. Now, though, he understood why Ibram Gaunt, champion of human life and soldier of the Divine Emperor, would so personally loathe the likes of the monster called Skara. He kills to serve chaos. Any death serves him. Here, we can be sure, he will have butchered any imperially loyal hive workers en masse. We can also be sure that if he believes defeat is close, he will begin a systematic purge of any living things, including his own troops. Mass suicide, to honor chaos, to honor the blasphemy they call corn." Gaunt coughed at the word as if his gorge was rising, and a murmur of revulsion passed through the assembled ghosts. "That is a way we have of winning. We can defeat him, and we can convince him he will be defeated, and thus save us the bother of killing them all. If he thinks he is losing, he will begin to slaughter his own as a final hymn of defiance and worship." Kafran's mind swam round to the present. Adare was speaking.
"Fethin more of them. Kaf, look!"
Kith soldiers, in their hundreds, were marching out onto the concourse to fall in behind the rows already slaughtered. Not slaughtered, thought Kafran. Harvested. It reminded him of the rows of corn stooks back on the meadows of Tanith, as the mechanical threshers came in, reaping row after row. Despite the sickness in his stomach, a sickness that pinched and viced with each echo of gunfire, Kafran smiled.
"What?"
Adare asked.
"Nothing." "So what do we do now? What's the plan?"
Kafran grinned again. He realized he did have a plan, after all, and he'd already executed it. When he'd brought that tower crashing down, he'd made Sholan Skara believe a significant enemy force was inside Oscre Hive, made him believe that defeat loomed. As a result, Skara was ordering the Kith to kill themselves, 100 at a time. 100 every 30 seconds. Cafran sat back. His aching body throbbed. There was a las burn across his thigh he hadn't even noticed before.
"You're laughing," said Adare, perplexed.
Cafran realized he was.
"Here's the plan," he said at last.
"We wait."
Afternoon squalls from the ocean were clearing the smoke from Osprey Hive, but even the wind and rain couldn't pry the stink of death from the great refinery. Formations of Imperial gunships shrieked overhead, pummeling the rain clouds with their firewash. Gaunt found Cafran asleep amongst several hundred other ghosts under a tower piling. The young trooper snapped to attention as soon as he realized who had woken him.
"I want you with me," Gaunt said.
They crossed the great concourse of the refinery city, passing squads of ghosts, Volponi, and Abaloi guardsmen, detailed at building-to-building clearance. Shouts and whistles rang commands through the air as the Imperial forces took charge of the island hive and marshaled ranks of dead-eyed prisoners away.
"I never thought you to be a tactical man, Cafran," Gaunt began as they walked together.
Cafran shrugged.
"I have to say I made it up as I went along, sir."
Gaunt stopped and turned to smile at the young ghost.
"Don't tell Korbeck that, for Feth's sake. He'll get ideas."
Cafran laughed. He followed Gaunt into a blockhouse of thick stone where oil drum stacks had been packed aside to open a wide space. Sodium lamps burned from the roof. A ring of Imperial guardsmen edged the open area. Volponi mostly, but there were some ghosts, including Rawn and other officers. In the center of the open area, a figure kneeled, shackled. He was a tall, shaven-headed man in black, tight-fitting robes. Powerful, Cafran presumed, had he been allowed to stand. His eyes were sunken and dark and glittered out at Gaunt and Cafran as they approached from the edge of the guarding circle.
"The little juicy maggot of the Imperial,"
the figure began, in a soft, sugar-sweet tone. Gaunt smacked him to the ground with the back of his fist to silence him. "Sholan Skara," Gaunt said to Cafran, pointing down at the sprawled figure who was trying to rise, despite his fetters, blood spurting from his smashed mouth. Cafran's eyes opened wide. He gazed down. Gaunt pulled out his bolt pistol, checked it, cocked it, and offered it to Cafran.
"I thought you might like the honor."
"There's no court here. None's needed."
"I think you deserve the duty."
Cafran took the proffered gun and looked down at Skara. The monster had pulled himself up onto his knees and grinned up at Cafran, his teeth pink with blood.
"Sir,"
Cafran began.
"He dies here, today, now, by the Emperor's will," Gaunt said curtly. "A duty I would dearly like to have saved for myself. But this is your glory, Cafran. You wrought this."
"It's an honor, Commissar."
"Do it."
"Do it. Do it, little ghost boy. What are you waiting for?"
Skara's sick, sweet tones were clammy and insistent. Cafran tried not to look down into the sunken, glittering eyes. He raised the gun.
"He wants death, sir."
"Indeed he does. It is the least we can do,"
Gaunt snapped. Cafran lowered the gun and looked at Gaunt, aware that every eye in the chamber was on him.
"No, sir. He wants death.
Like you told us. Death is the ultimate victory for him. He craves it.
We've won here on Sapientia.
I won't soil that victory by handing the enemy what he wants."
Cafran passed the gun back to Gaunt, grip first.
"Cafran? You really want to punish him, Commissar?"
"Let him live."
Gaunt thought for a moment. He smiled.
"Take him away," he said to the honor guard as it closed ranks around Skara. "I may have to promote you someday," Gaunt told Cafran as he led him away.
Behind them, Skara screamed and begged and pleaded and shrieked, and lived to do so. Again and again. Bryn Milo, Gaunt's young adjutant, brought the Commissar a tin cup of caffeine brew and the data slates he hadn't requested, though he had been about to. Gaunt was sat on a camp chair on the deck outside his command shelter, gazing out at the Tanith lines and the emerald glades of Monthax beyond them. Milo gave the data slates to the Commissar and then paused as he turned away, guilty as he realized what he had done. Gaunt eyed the slates, scrolling the charts on the lit fascia of the top one. McCall's surveys of the western swamps, and the orbital scans of Monthax. Thank you. The boy tried to cover his mistake. I thought you'd want to look them over, he began. When you attack today, you'll... Who said I'd attack today? Milo was silent. He shrugged. I guess. After last night's action, so close, I thought... Gaunt got up and looked the boy squarely in the eyes. Enough of your guesses. You know the trouble they might cause. For me. For you. For all the ghosts. Milo sighed and leaned against the rail of the command shed's stoop where he attended the commissar. Mid-morning light lit the marshy groves beyond, lighting the tops of the tree cover an impossibly vivid green. Armored vehicles rumbled through the mire somewhere, kilometers away. There was the distant thump of guns.
Is there some crime? He ventured at last. In anticipation, sir? Isn't that what a good adjutant is supposed to do? Anticipate his officer's needs and requirements ahead of time. Have the right thing to hand.
No crime in that, Bryn, Gaunt replied, sitting back down. That's what makes a good adjutant, and you're making a fine job of being one, but you anticipate too well sometimes. Sometimes it spooks me, and I know you. Others might view it another way. I don't need to tell you that.
No.
You know what happened in orbit last week? That was too close.
That was a conspiracy. I was set up.
Gaunt wiped the sweat from his temple. You were. But it was easy to do. You'd be an easy victim for a determined manipulator. And if it came to that again, I'm not sure I could protect you.
About that, I have a request, sir. You do protect me.
You have since Tanith. I owe you. But for your intervention, I would have died with your world.
And from that you know I can handle myself in a combat situation. I want to be issued with a gun. I want to fight with the Tanith in the next push. I don't care what squad you put me in.
You've seen your share of fighting, Bryn, Gaunt said, shaking his head. But I won't make a soldier out of you. You're too young.
I was 18 3 days ago, the boy said flatly.
Gaunt frowned. He hadn't realized. He flapped away a persistent fly and sipped his cup. Not a lot I can say to counter that, he admitted. He sat back down. What if we make a deal? Milo looked back at him with bright eyes and a cautious smile.
Like what?
I give you a brevet field rank, a gun, and stick you next to Korbeck. In return, you stop anticipating. Completely.
Completely?
That's right. Well, I don't mean stop doing your job, just stop doing things that people could take the wrong way. What do you say?
I'd like that. Thank you. A deal.
Gaunt flashed him a rare smile. Now go and find me Korbeck and McCall. I need to run through some details with them. Milo paused and Gaunt turned, looking down off the stoop to see the colonel and the scout sergeant standing side by side, looking up at him expectantly.
Milo suggested that we should stop by. When we had a chance, Korbeck said.
Is now a good time?
Gaunt turned back to find Milo, but the boy, probably on the basis of another wise anticipation, had made himself scarce. Part 10. Witch Hunt. Val lifted the Tanith camo cloak off the sensor on the floor, like a magician about to perform a conjuring trick. There was a hushed silence around the ship's hold as the veil came away. The game was simple and enticing and completely fixed, and Sergeant Val and the boy mascot made a good team. They had a jar of fat, jumping lice, scooped from the troop ship's grain silos, and that beaten old sensor borrowed from the Ecclesiarch Chapel. The sensor was a hollow ball of rusty metal, whose hemispheres hinged open so that incense could be crumbled into the holder inside and lit. The ball's surface was dotted with star-shaped holes. "The game is simple," Val began, holding up the jar and jiggling it so all could see the half-dozen thumb-sized bugs inside. He held it in his mechanical hand, and the servos hummed and whirred as he agitated the glass.
"It's a guessing game, a game of chance. No trickery, no guile."
Val was something of a showman, and Milo liked him very much. He was one of what Milo regarded as the inner circle of ghosts, a close friend of Korbeck and Larkin, one of a gaggle of tight-knit friends and comrades mustered together from the militia of Tanith Magna at the founding. Val's sharp tongue and speak-your-mind attitude had retarded his promotion chances early on, but then he had lost his arm on Fortis Binary during the heroic reconquest of the Forge world, and by the time of the now legendary actions of Menazoid Epsilon, he had been made a squad sergeant. Many thought it was well past time. Next to the ruthless command styles of Rawn and Fagor, and the intense military mindset of the likes of McColl and the Commissar himself, Val, like the beloved Colonel Corbeck, injected a note of humanity and genial compassion into the Ghost's command structure. The men liked him. He told jokes as often as Corbeck, and they were for the most part funnier and cruder. His prosthetic arm proved he was not shy of close fighting, and he could, in his own informal, garrulous way, spin a fine, inspiring speech to rouse his squad if the need called for it. Just now, though, in one of the troopship's echoing holds, with an audience of off-duty guardsmen roused from their cots and stoves all around, he was turning his charismatic tongue to something far more important. The pitch. "Here's the deal, my friends, my brave fellow guardsmen. Praise be the Golden Throne. Here's the deal." He spoke clearly, slowly, so that his sing-song Tanith accent wouldn't confuse the other guard soldiers here. Three other regiments were sharing this transport with the Ghosts. Big, blonde, square-jawed brutes from the Royal Volpone 50th. The so-called Blue Bloods. Sallow-skinned, idle-looking, compact men from the 5th Slammabadden, and tall, tanned, long-haired types from the 2nd Rohan Deepers. Worlds and accents, separated by a common tongue. Val worked his crowd with care and precision, making sure nothing he said was lost or misunderstood. He handed the sensor to Milo, who opened it. "See now, a metal ball with surface holes. The grain lice go in the ball." He tipped a couple from his jar out into the sensor as Milo held it ready. "And my young friend here closes it up. Notice how I've scratched a number next to all the holes. 33 holes, a number next to each. No tricks, no guile. You can examine the ball if you like." Val took the rusty ball from Milo and set it on the floor where all could see. A large washer welded to the sensor's base stopped it from rolling. "Now, see, I sets it down. The lice want the light, right? So, sooner or later, they'll hop out through one of the holes. There's the game. We wager on the number."
"And we lose our money,"
said a deeper near the front. His voice twanged with that odd, rounded Rowan accent.
"We'll all make a bet, friend," Val said. "I will, you will, anyone else. If you guess the right number, or get closest, you win the pot. No tricks, no guile."
As if on cue, a bug emerged from one of the star-shaped holes and lit off onto the deck, where a blue blood crunched it sourly underfoot.
"No matter," Val cried. "Plenty more where he came from. And if you've seen the grain silos, you'll know what I mean."
That brought general laughter and a keen sense of suffering comradeship. Milo smiled. He loved the way Val could play a crowd.
"What if we don't trust you, Ghost?"
asked a blue blood, the big ox who had mashed the bug. He wore his grey and gold twill breeches and black boots, but was stripped down to his undershirt. His body was a mass of well-nourished muscles, and he stood two heads taller than Val. Arrogance oozed from him. Milo tensed. He knew that some rivalry existed between the Ghosts and the Blue Bloods ever since Voltamand. No one had ever said, but the rumor was that the Blue Bloods' own commanders, steering the invasion force, had ordered the barrage on the Voltis riverbed where so many Ghosts had died. The Blue Bloods, so high and emperor damned mighty, seemed to despise the common-born Ghosts, but then they despised everyone. This aristocratic giant, with his hooded eyes and bullying manner, had at least 6 friends in the crowd, and all were as big as him. What the feth do they feed them on back home to raise such giants? Milo wondered. Val, unconcerned, got down off the crates he had been using as a stage and approached the giant. He held out his hand. It whirred.
"Keglan Val, Sergeant, Tanith first and only. I admire a man who can express his doubts, Sergeant.
Major Gisholm Danver de Banzi Haight Gilbert, Royal Volpone 50th.
The giant didn't offer to take the outstretched hand.
Well, Major, seems you've no reason to trust a lowlife like me, but it's all a game, see? No tricks, no guile. We all make a bet. We all have a laugh. We all pass the voyage a little quicker.
Major Gilbert did not seem convinced. You've rigged it. I'm not interested if you place a bet. He swung his look past Varl and took in Milo. Let your boy do it.
Oh, no, that's just silly, Varl cried. He's just a kid. He knows nothing about the fine and graceful art of gamesmanship. You want to play this with gamblers?
No, Gilbert said simply. Others in the crowd agreed, and not just bluebloods. Some seemed in danger of walking away, disinterested.
Very well, very well,
Varl said, as if it was breaking his heart.
The boy can play in my stead.
I don't want to, sir, Milo squeaked. He prayed his outburst had the right mix of reluctance and concern, and that it didn't sound too much on cue.
Now then, lad,
Varl said, turning to him and putting a heavy bionic arm around his shoulders paternally.
Be good now and play along so that the nice gentleman here can enjoy a simple game.
Unseen to all others present, he winked at Milo. Milo fought the fiercest battle of his life not to laugh.
Okay,
he said.
The boy will play in my place,
Varl said, turning back to the crowd and raising his arms. There was cheers and applause in reply. They set to it. A larger crowd gathered. Paper markers were handed out and coin produced. Gilbert decided to play, as did two Rowan Deepers and three of the Slammerbatten. In the crowd, secondary bets were laid on winners and losers. Varl opened the censer and took up his jar. Gilbert plucked it from his hand, opened it, and dropped the lice out onto the deck, crunching them all underfoot. He held it out to one of his men.
Rabel, go fetch fresh lice from the silos.
Sir.
What is this?
Varl gasped, dropping to his knees and wiping away what seemed to Milo a real tear as he surveyed his crushed insects.
Do you not even trust my lice, Major Gilbert, Blueblood, sir?
I don't trust anything I can crush with my boot,
Gilbert replied, looking down, and apparently dangerously close to stamping on Varl, too. A tidal change swept through the secondary betting, some of it in sympathy with the damaged ghost and his crushed pets. Some sensing trickery was routed and heaping money on the blue blood major. You could have drugged them, overfed them. They seemed docile. You could place your money on the lower holes so that the sluggish things simply fell from the bottom as gravity pulled. Gilbert smiled at his deduction, and his men growled approval. So did several of the wily Slammerbatten, and Milo was afraid the mood might turn ugly.
I tell you what,
Varl said to the major as he got up. The Blueblood's second was returning with a jar packed full of agitated lice and semi-digested meal where he had scooped it from the dank silos.
We'll use your pick of the bugs, and you can set the sensor whichever way up you like.
Varl pulled a cargo hook from the crates behind him to use as a makeshift base.
Happy?
Gilbert nodded. They made ready. The gamblers, Milo included, prepared to make their guess on the paper slips provided. Varl flexed his good shoulder as if easing out an old hurt. A signal. The next cue.
I'll play this too,
Kafran said, pushing forward through the huddle. He seemed to sway, and he stank of sacra. Many gave him a wide berth.
Kaffee, no, you're not up to it,
Varl murmured. Kafran was pulling out a weight of coins, rolls of thick, high-issue discs.
Give me the paper. I like a bet,
Kafran mumbled, slurring.
Let your ghost play,
Gilbert growled with a smirk as Varl began to protest. It looked to all present like the Tanith showman had lost control of his simple game, and if there had been any trickery in it, any guile, then all of it was ruined now. The first lice went in. Gilbert spun the censer and set it down. Markers were overturned. A Slammerbatten came closest to guessing the exit by three holes. Milo was nowhere near and seemed to whimper. Kafran raged as his money was scooped away. He produced more. A deeper won the next, the winner of the last round given the honor of placing the censer. He was no closer than five holes,
but the others were grouped and very wrong. Milo begged Varl to let him stop, but Varl shook him off, glancing sidelong at the glowering Gilbert. Gilbert won the next by guessing within two. He collected a massive pile of coins, and one of the deepers dropped out in disgust. The level of the bets, and off-game bets, had risen considerably, and now real money was at stake. Cash was changing hands all around. The Bluebloods were jubilant, and so were others. Others still bemoaned their losses. Two more slammer button and another deeper stepped up to play, their bets bolstered by whip rounds amongst their friends. No Blueblood dared to play against Gilbert. Flushed with success, Gilbert placed his one pot again and doubled it. Some of the guardsmen present, especially the deepers and the watching ghosts, had never seen so much ready cash in their lives. Caffran made a fuss and swigged from a bottle of Sacra, imploring his friend Brostin for a sub, which was eventually, reluctantly, given. The next round. Gilbert and a deeper, each three holes away from the winning aperture, split the now considerable pot. The next round. Playing was Gilbert, three of the Slammabadden, two deepers, Caffran, now subbing from a worried-looking Raglan, Brostin having exited in a convincing rage, and Milo. A huge pile of wages. Caffran came out two off the mark. A Slammabadden was one off. Gilbert was on the other side of the censer. Milo was spot on. Howls, anger, jubilation, tumult.
It was just lucky, Varl said, collecting up the winnings. Are we done?
The boy got a fluke, Gilbert said, ordering his subalterns to empty their pockets. Another big wager was assembled. The deepers had dropped out, and so had Caffran, leaving the chamber with Raglan. The Slammabadden mustered their strengths into one wager. Milo turned the censer and set it down. Silence. The bug ticked and bounced against the inside of the metal ball. It emerged. Milo had it again, spot on. Pandemonium. It seemed like a riot would overturn the troop bay. Varl collected the winnings and the censer and pulled Milo out of the chamber by the scruff of his tunic. Men were shouting, milling around, and a fight had begun over the outcome of one of the side bets. In the companionway that led back to the Tanith troop deck, Varl and Milo rejoined Caffran, Raglan, and Brostin. They were all laughing, and Caffran seemed suddenly sober. He would have to wash his tunic to get the stink of Sacra out of it, of course. Varl grinned at them and held up the bulky pouch containing their winnings.
"Spoils to be divided, my friends," he announced to them, slapping Milo across the back with his bionic arm.
He had never got used to its strength, and Milo nearly fell. Caffran uttered a warning. Dark shapes loomed down the companionway behind them. It was Gilbert and four of his men.
"You'll pay for that trickery, whore's son," Gilbert told Varl.
"It was a fair game," began Varl, but realized at once that his silver tongue was useless now.
There were five on each side, but each of the Bluebloods towered over Brostin, the largest of the Tanith present. In a close-quarter brawl, the ghosts might score, draw even perhaps, but it would be bloody.
"Is there a problem?"
asked the sixth member of the Tanith scam team. Bragg pulled his vast bulk into the light behind his comrades, squinting in a relaxed way down at the five Bluebloods. He seemed to fill the corridor. The ghosts parted to let Bragg lumber through. He adopted the slow gait Varl had trained him in to emphasize his power.
"Go away, little Bluebloods. Don't make me hurt you," he said,
repeating the cue Varl had also given him. It came out stilted and false, but the Bluebloods were too amazed at his size to notice. They turned. With a final scowl, Gilbert followed them. The ghosts began to laugh so hard, they wept. Below him, Monthax, green, impenetrable. Gaunt gazed down through the arched viewports of the hexathedral sanctity, studying the distant surface of the planet that, within a week, his forces would be assaulting. From time to time, he referred to a data slate map in his hand, checking off geographical details. The dense jungle cover was the biggest problem they faced. They had no idea of the hidden enemy's strength. Advance reports suggested a vast force of chaos filth had retreated from a recent engagement at Pyolitus and dug in here. Warmaster Makaroth was taking no chances. Around the huge bulk of the orbiting hexathedral, a colossal towered platform designed as a mustering point for the invasion forces, great legions massed.
Over a dozen huge troopships were already docked around the crenellated rim of the hexathedral's skirt platform, like fat swine at the teats of their obese mother, and tugs were easing another in now to join them. More were due. Further away, Imperial battlecruisers and escort ships, including the frigate Navarre, on which Gaunt and the Ghosts had been stationed for a while, sat at high orbit anchor, occasionally buzzing out clouds of attack squadrons heading off for surface runs or patrol sweeps. Gaunt turned from the windows and stepped down a short flight into the cool, echoing vastness of one of the Sanctity's main tactical chapels, the Orrery. A vast circular dial was set flush in the center of the chamber's floor, 30 meters across and made of intricate, interlocking moving parts of brass and gold, like a giant timepiece. As it whirred and cycled, the three-dimensional globe of colored light it projected upwards altered and spun, advancing data, chart runes, bars of information across the luminous surface. Trim, uniformed guard officers, robed members of the Ecclesiarch and the Munitorium, Navy commanders in their Segmentum Pacificus deck dress, and the hooded deaconal staff of the Hexathedral itself, prowled the edges of the Great Light Orrery, consulting the data and conferring in small groups. Skeletal servitors, emaciated, wired into the machine banks via cables from their eyes, spines, mouths and hands, hunkered in booth cribs, murmuring and chattering. Around the sides of the great chamber, under cloistered roofing, great chart tables were arranged at intervals, each showing different sections of Monthax. Staff groups stood around every table, engaged in more specific and detailed planning sessions. The air chimed with an